Like a lava flow, the protest movement in the Arab world has arrived in full force in Libya. In Tripoli, the equivalent of the parliament building is on fire. There are rumors that Muammar Gaddafi has fled the capital city, maybe even the country. And the justice minister has reportedly resigned in protest over the excessive use of force against unarmed protesters, an estimated 200 killed in Tripoli and in Libya's second largest city, Benghazi, over 6 days. A woman named Sarah in Tripoli told the BBC today that Gaddafi is bringing in foreign mercenaries to suppress the demonstrators.
What kind of person brings people from outside of his own country if he claims to be from this country, if he claims to be Libyan? How can he bring people from outside to shoot and kill?
Let's get an update. The BBC's James Reynolds joins us from London. And James, we know that many internet connections have been cut, but there are reports of these pro-government organizations hunting down protesters in Tripoli. Meanwhile, across the country, in the second largest city, Benghazi, the protesters seem to have come through the worst of the violence with a victory. So what's going on?
It's very, very difficult to tell, particularly trying to monitor it from outside the borders. We're obviously keeping a very close eye here from London. We have heard reports that protesters, in the words of some reports, are in control of Benghazi, although we've heard other reports that they're incredibly worried that a government counterattack will come in the next few hours or the next few days. We know, of course, that there have been huge protests in Tripoli as well, and we all saw the speech given by one of Colonel Gaddafi's sons, Saif Gaddafi, very late into the night in Tripoli, a warning that his regime, his government, would fight until the very last bullet.
Right. Well, in that rambling speech that he made, he also said Libya is not Egypt or Tunisia. And we understand that in one way he's right, that Libya is actually a mass of tribal allegiances as opposed to, you know, nationalist fervor, divisions that extend to the military. So we understand that in some places, parts of the military are coming to the aid of the protesters. How does the way Libya is made up make this potentially different?
I think we'll have to wait and see. I think you've put your finger on it with the question that it may be more tribal than nationalistic, that in Egypt it was very easy in some ways for the protesters to unite because they united around the idea of Egypt as an alternative to Mubarak, whereas in Libya it's very difficult to see to what extent protesters will be able to unite around a single idea. A lot of people are saying that there is maybe a danger of fragmentation where, in the end, when a society starts to break down, tribal allegiances become much more important than the allegiance to the country.
Yeah. And yet, how unusual is it that the justice minister, in stepping down, says Gaddafi's regime is now in the trash of history because he's betrayed his nation and his people? How unusual is that kind of language?
Very unusual, but in the wake of Tunisia, in the wake of Egypt, and in the wake of attempted demonstrations in other countries, I think we can say that the rule book, the playbook in the Middle East, is changing. And I think the rules about what people can and cannot say are also changing with that. Just in some historical context, we may be seeing the gradual result now of the disintegration of the Ottoman Empire and the establishment of colonial regimes and rulers more than 100 years ago.
Well, and yet we also have these reports of these yellow hats, these African mercenaries wearing yellow construction hard hats that Gaddafi has reportedly turned on his people. We'll listen to hear more, as you said, about a possible crackdown coming in a few hours. But the U.S. and Britain have recently tried to work with Muammar Gaddafi. And we remember when he famously, after 9/11, volunteered to go find or fight Osama bin Laden, seeing himself as more a friend of the U.S. at this point. So what kind of questions does that raise?
Well, it's an astonishing trajectory if you look at it over, last 30 years. He went from mad dog, in Ronald Reagan's phrase, to cautious friend in 2003 when he gave up his nuclear aspirations and Tony Blair went to go and visit him in his tent, now to being back out again, possibly in the words of, well, perhaps some Republican sympathizers, mad dog Mark II at the moment. He is, in very many ways, a very difficult man to read, to try and predict. But we do know two facts, and these are facts. Number one, he is the longest ruling ruler in that particular part of the world, more than 42 years. And number two, the crackdown that's happened in the last few days is the most violent crackdown in any of the Arab states we have seen so far. So the longest serving ruler has ordered the most violent crackdown. I think that probably tells us as much as we need to know.
Meanwhile, other parts of the region, Bahrain's rulers have offered talks with the opposition groups there, but the talks aren't happening, maybe because protesters' demands have now morphed from wanting more democracy to wanting an end to the monarchy. Yemen's embattled president has rejected calls for him to step down, but he has also offered to begin a dialogue with protesters. Taking a look at the countries that have had seemingly their worst flare-ups and are now in sort of this what happens next stage, what do you think happens next?
We begin to see a pattern, don't we? Huge protest followed very quickly by an offer of dialogue from the government. And then in the case of Egypt and Tunisia, it was followed very, very quickly after that by the end of those particular governments. So I don't think the governments of Bahrain and Yemen will be looking all particularly pleasantly at the pattern of those events. Right. We'll have to see very closely what form that dialogue may take in those countries, without also perhaps underestimating the support provided to those countries by the United States and Britain.
And looking at countries where there haven't been these huge protests, in Jordan, 8 protesters have been injured, in Syria, a day of rage didn't materialize. Now, The Economist magazine has something called the Shoe Throwers Index. It's a sort of an unrest index. And it says that unrest in Syria and Jordan is higher than in both Tunisia and Bahrain, over 50%. That's also the case in Saudi Arabia and Algeria, by the way. So is it your sense that this is, we're almost even just in the middle of this?
I think what we do know is that it's almost impossible to predict what will happen next. And just because there are no protests in any particular country on any given day doesn't mean that those protests won't start. It did take a number of weeks between those big protests in Tunisia and now the huge protests that we're seeing in Libya. Sometimes there is a time lag. Sometimes it takes just a few days.
That's James Reynolds of the BBC speaking to us from London with an overview of what's going on right now in this constantly percolating story. James, thank you.
My pleasure.